Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
thinking candles. And I just want to try and get to the idea of what a candle is and how that differs from thinking styles and methods. So a candle is a general state of mind that you have, that you present outside the outside world, how you respond. So if you are, say, tricking someone, and you're a trickster, and you have a candor of a confidence person, someone who is not genuine, or you may have someone who arrives and you've just had an accident and there's someone who's genuinely concerned for you, and they have the candor of a rescuer who's genuinely engaged. There's various things, say, if you went to a police station and you had to report something stolen, and the policeman there was picking his nose and playing cards and stuff like that, and say, yeah, what do you want? That policeman wouldn't have the candor or thinking style that you have. Now, does this concept of candor actually have a sort of consequence in the outside world? Yes, it does. So in the area of intellectual property, there's the idea of displaying due candor. That is a suite of behaviors which is expected to surround a style of position. So if you're in the position of an inventor applying for a patent, which is a monopoly bought from the state in exchange for exposure of how the invention is done, so you're given a limited monopoly, so you're encouraged to share secrets, but then the state will help you enforce monopoly. That's the process of it there. But there's a due candor there that you have to explain as if you're on the side of the patent examiner, and you have to expose everything. And so if the patent examiner founds one area which you are trying to deceive them, they say, due candor, you're not explaining everything, and you can lose all your patents. So similarly to a lawyer, the lawyer is expected to help the court process, to help the client, but also the court process. So a due candor of a lawyer, they're expected to not deceive the court, and therefore this understanding of due candor is why you would, if you were guilty, the lawyer wouldn't ask, were you guilty? Are you guilty? Did you commit it? Because if you said yes, the lawyer could no longer help you with due candor. So it's a sort of an idea of candor. Then after you've got the candor, you've got a variety of skills that you can go through. But one of the things I did note looking into it is looking at the overall problems of who's teaching what, who's explaining what to whom. Due candor of someone explaining something is that they will do their best efforts to get a complete explanation, and if they give you an explanation, they will in due candor reveal if to their knowledge there is anyone who disagrees with it. That sort of that candor of a scientist, scientist has scientific candor, certain things that they're obligated, ways they've got obligated to behave. They have the candor of someone who is doesn't have a reputation, is not stating it to inform you, but they're an ambassador for the facts and warn you of, tell you about the quality of the facts. And part of the quality of the facts is people, if they disagree with you or various things like that. Now, I come across a few examples where people can't operate with scientific candor at every aspect of their lives. It's simply too expensive. And so they flop to the I'm here sort of like sleep mode when they're talking about things. And so unless you wake them up and get them on the candor trail and explain, do this a little bit, it's almost impossible to get a rational response, because essentially some of the arguments take a little bit of time. Notice that there's a bit of wind coming up here. I'm out in the Australian bush and I'm going to do a little bit of a podcast after this, but this is dealing with the idea of candor. So a lot of people, there is this paradox, and a lot of people are capable of due candor, but the environment there doesn't support it, and often it is suppressed. It's something that people desire, that people in a group do not show due candor, due respect, due justice to other people outside the group. It's part of the human condition to create a group consensus of behavior, and some of that behavior will be unfair and push someone out of the group with a legitimate viewpoint. And so the process to do, in order to do that, is that these people must be in a state of dubious candor. They must be able to stop listening and they have to be in a position, a resting position, for which consent is required for them to produce the candor, to produce the outcome. So what happens is that you can have someone identified by the group, at the top of the group, as not to be given the time of day, not to be given the voice and stuff like that. And everyone else, majority of situations, is set such they are limited. They might be aware, but they are aware that they can only deliver a focused candor, effective candor, in the area of their expertise, or particularly say scientific expertise. So you'll have experts in an area which seem, although you would say, would stand up and universally argue something, but they're aware that their candor or their behavior has to be very focused on what they are expert at, because if they trip up and make a mistake or dilute their candor, they're unable to operate. I hope I can make this clear. So this is part of the sort of another layer of candor that scientists are very much aware of. Oh, that's a very interesting thing to look through the bush. I've just seen something through there. Scientists are very much aware of the limitations that fellow scientists are through, and they will, you can probably hear the dry, very dry grass going underneath me. I'm trying to find something reasonably cool place to podcast from. So look, scientists will be aware that they have to be humble about their own processing ability, their own understanding, and in a situation where it's constrained with time, it's not a very positive thing, and it's, so you can't expect them to engage. They're sort of been employed as scientists, so they really have to knuckle down and focus. And to a certain extent, when they're given contradictory or corrupt situation, at the end of the day, there's just so many corrupt situations that, and so many things which aren't happening right, they can't engage and support. So you often, as a scientist, you can actually propose an idea, get the idea across and understanding, but nothing happens after that because this is canned idea. So you wind up sort of, a lot of the scientists hear what you're saying, understand what they're saying, but you know, shrug the shoulders, what can they do? And then people who are non-scientific don't sort of provide the sequence of listening for you to actually put an idea to them. And that's the way it is. And it's the way it is, I think, such that they can be in a state of rest, mental rest. They're not thinking about anything in particular, and a state of easily manipulated, I suppose might be the word, that they're obviously they're sort of intellectual, being flied to death out here. This is truly Australian summer kicking out. So this is what you call insect flies flying about, but they've sort of settled on my back, thank goodness, not buzzing around the microphone. I have the view that people want to be in a state of rest, don't want to be alarmed or pushed or given new information. And the reason that that's there is that we want them in a state of rest so that we can invest the minimum amount of intellectual energy to get them to do something that we want them to do, the state wants them to do. So if you've got someone who's very highly educated, contemplates things, thinks things out, you can't give them a simple pamphlet and they won't spend $5,000 buying a solid cell or something along that. They won't buy a cruise. That they'll think it through. They'll overcomplicate things. So there's very much a desire for the zombie. So you've got the scientists who are sort of trapped by the zombie state, and the zombies, zombies of thought. But you can't go, and it's nothing to fight against. It's something to realise, and that if this is the case, you need, if you want to move, you have to have an interface, a zombie interface, which will calm things down, camouflage what's going on, get things underway, and recognise things for what they are. So if the shingle is set up, the system is set up that you have to go through these hoops to get funding to go ahead, and that's not going to happen, there's no point stressing about it. There's no point stressing about the zombie nation of people who aren't really listening and going across. It's a matter of understanding, provisioning, such that they're expending minimum energy on you in terms of listening to you or integrating. There's a sort of reciprocal requirement to spend a minimal amount of energy on them, but to invest in respect, i.e. to respect them as individuals, because the play is further down the track, is that when, heaven forbid, you should actually make somewhere, you've got a respect a record ahead. So I'm just trying to actually understand all this. And then this is the entire candor of thought. So you can go on about how people should think and the correct ways of thinking and the incorrect way of thinking, but there is this way of not thinking. And I think this is the major thing that I've realized, is that there is a state of human existence which is not thinking about things too deeply. And the reason we do this is, A, it's tough, but B, if you don't think too deeply, you are a better commodity. You're easier to use. So I just tapped a fly off the microphone there. Hoping that's all okay. I think there's this, and there is this model to go ahead, and people have sort of two approaches to the model. One is to remove the foundations for these people and move them away, which is sort of a foundational area. But then there's an area to just subtly, day in, day out, gradually change their canvas that they're looking at. And then do sort of a Darwin approach, and then you do this for sufficient people. So rather than a mass campaign like, say, the climate campaign, you pick away at certain areas and just move it where you can. And that's probably mathematically the best thing that you can do. And observe and try and understand this candor of not thinking, and the fact that if you are unaware of this, it means that if you introduce things, it is very difficult to get going if they're not listening to you at the start. So I haven't solved this process. I've been able to, with people who I can speak long enough with, start to describe it, and there's that, yes, we can basically understand that the people aren't going to be listening to you, or I've had a similar experience, or yep, that's the way it is. And this is a quintessential problem, I think, of the human race. If you really look at it on a big scale, we've discovered fire, and now we're cooking the planet, and we don't know how. We're saying, how do we change our behavior? How do we change everything? Everything, we are locked, we're addicted to this behavior, and we're going to kill the planet. We're killing all the plants, we're poisoning all the oceans, we're cooking the planet. How do we do it? And the answer, I think, is there's these mechanical big things, but we have to stop. It's a behavior change, and if you're looking at behavior change, we've got our inability. It's not the ability to change behavior. It's the inability to change behavior, and the inability to change behavior is the fundamental nature of a civilization. It's sort of like the inertia, behavioral inertia. So, if people are bouncing around much, we tend to cut the extremes of behavior, create a behavioral inertia. And you don't want anyone thinking about anything too much. You know, thinking you want someone to consume without remorse. You want someone to burn coal, burn petrol without remorse to do it. So there is no problem. What are you looking at? What are you looking at, Whitey? So there is this thing to get to. This is way before trying to say. Critique the different types of deductive thinking and inductive thinking and exploratory thinking. Yeah, I think there's probably those three areas here, and there is no thinking. There is another area of no thinking whatsoever. It's quorum thinking. That is so and so popular? Will you take an upvote on it? Basically, a quorum thing is the value of a property. You know, before it took a year's salary to own a property, now it takes 10, 30 years to own a property. And that value of a property is not an intrinsic thing, it's a quorum thing. So there's those quorum thought patterns. So let's go through. There's quorum thinking, there's deductive thinking, there's scientific induction, and then there's exploratory thinking, which is sort of a thinking that you need a head to actually measure something, to go out and see, you know, I'm going out, is this bushland going to burn? Is this, if it's going to burn, what is the quorum aspect? What is the deductive aspect? It's sort of like there's a three regions, playing boards, and a lot of people actually don't get onto that playing board. They sort of have a relationship with it where they are in a restful state, ready to consume or do things like a zombie. So I hope I've got that through. I hope that's an interesting podcast on thinking, not styles, but candor. That this is a set of behaviors associated with your thinking. So not your thinking capability, but it's your behavioral process which brings up certain your intent behind it, or the lack of intent, or where your intent is actually not your personal intent, but it is an intent of the market system or your upbringing. So I hope you like that podcast, and I'll go on and read this next chapter. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.